everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For the purposes of this email, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
Yes, and here's how this podcast works. We do a lot of stuff here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. We talk about a lot of things. We do a lot of podcasts. But that's us. That's us talking about our stuff. We want to hear from you. We want to answer your questions. We want to respond to your criticisms. We want to give you the platform to basically join in the conversation yourself. So here's how that works. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box if anyone wants to actually send in a physical letter or anything else. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
You can write into the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we missed last week's episode because Whitney was out of town. Whitney, you feeling re-energized? Feeling better?
Just exhausted because we were in Las Vegas, and that's not a relaxing Vegas.
No, that's not a weekend by the lake. That's
we had a nice few days in Las Vegas. We stayed in a hotel we wanted to stay at. We saw Billy Idol in concert.
Nice.
Billy Idol is 65 and he can still bring it.
Good for him. Appreciate it.
And he's clearly doing a lot of sit-ups. So I felt very insecure about my own body when 65-year-old Billy Idol took his shirt off on stage. It was a good time. We ate a lot and we drank a lot. I tried mezcal for the first time.
Ooh, how was it?
Very good. I hadn't found any sort of like tequila that I liked, but I never had just sort of like straight up mezcal. It's incredibly smoky, which is a flavor I prefer.
Yeah.
I like lapsang souchong and things that taste like a campfire.
Yeah.
And mezcal seems to be like the booze version of that.
That sounds right.
I don't drink to excess very often.
You didn't used to drink at all.
No, I was actually off booze until in my 30s. This is a tangent, but this is the kind of thing we talk about on this show.
We'll make it quick. We want to get to your letters.
Yeah, I didn't want to drink like an asshole, so I just didn't drink. I was a little maybe too aware of how like my friends in their early 20s behaved when they were on booze, so I just was a teetotaler.
Yeah.
So I didn't really... But by the time I was like 31, it's like, okay, I can taste now. I can handle it now. I'm an adult. I should be able to enjoy this. So I've been... seeking out new cocktails.
You're becoming a bit of a connoisseur as opposed to just a booze
hound.
I've
actually found like kinds of booze that I prefer over others, which is rare.
All right. Anyway. Well, let's jump into some letters. We're gonna catch up as best we can, but we never have time for everything. So, Whitney, let's just jump right in. Tell us about our first letter.
Here's a letter from Andrew. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi there, Bibbs and Monsieur McCool. C'est moi. Recently, I watched a movie I loved and watched all the time on HBO or Cinemax in the late 80s and early 90s and was surprised at one of the supporting characters. The movie is My Best Friend is a Vampire.
Oh, I remember that.
A ridiculous, cheesy movie that I still find delightful, mostly because of René Auberjonois and David Warner. Of course they're in it. But I was surprised to see an early performance by Kathy Bates as the love interest's mother.
Mm-hmm.
This brought to mind a question. What's a film that you watched when you were young that featured a performer that is now famous that you didn't even think about until a later revisit? Another good example is Groundhog Day with the supporting role played by Michael Shannon, well before anybody recognized his face. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, there's this interesting thing where, a lot of actors, the majority of actors, they don't, like, have their first role as a really big one, and then they break out. It happens once in a while, but it's really, really rare. This is why we talk about it. Most people have a few small parts, and then a few bigger parts, and then they start getting noticed, and they start getting bigger parts, and they have a breakout part, and then they get bigger roles. So what sometimes happens is you see some movies and then a few years later, someone became a big actor and then you didn't process all of a sudden that I'll give you my example off the top in My Boyfriend's Back, a comedy directed by Bob Balaban about a nerdy teenager who dies saving the life of the girl he likes in high school. And as he's dying, he asks her to the prom, and she says yes. So when he gets to heaven, he's like, I am not dying. I have a prom date. So he comes back as a flesh-eating zombie, but all he wants to do is go to prom. And meanwhile, she's like, you were dying. I thought I was just being polite. He's like, well, you promised. And unfortunately, he just has this desire to eat human flesh. And It's a dark, weird comedy. It's actually kind of funny. And so, two of the high school dudes in it, like the jock a-holes, are Matthew McConaughey and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
No kidding.
Yeah, they were not, really funny. You would not have known their names at the time. You would not have recognized them. You would watch that movie and go, oh, those guys were pretty good, like dude jerk bully types. And then like 10 years go by, you look back and like, is that Philip Seymour Hoffman with an axe in his head? My God, it is. And that guy's eating him. Neat.
We all got to start somewhere. Yeah. We recently reviewed the film Mystic Pizza, and I knew baby Matt Damon was in that one.
He has one line, and that's about whether or not you can eat the poop in a lobster.
Yeah. Again, gotta start somewhere. Yeah. So they needed somebody to play that part. It's always exciting to me when, because I like to delve through like crappy old slasher movies and horror films. It's like, oh, the guy from The Brain is the same guy from Twice Dead. Did you know that? Did you care? Do you know either of those movies? But it's always fun when you see a famous star getting their start in a slasher movie. Case in point, when I saw Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, Better Watch Out.
I haven't seen that one.
Laura Herring is in that one. Laura Lena Herring is in that film. From Mulholland Drive.
And The Punisher.
And The Punisher.
Yeah. Very good actor.
She was on the upswing for a while there, and then fell out of the public eye.
Damn shame. Very, very talented. They still work.
They've had a career. They're still getting a lot of work.
Should have been a big star.
She should have been a bigger star. Certainly deserved it. Oh, gosh, what else?
Oh, I have a good one. It's, so there's this movie called The Lavender Hill Mob. Have you ever seen The Lavender Hill Mob?
It's an Ealing comedy.
Yeah, it's an Ealing comedy, and Ealing is this studio in Britain that, they made all kinds of movies, but they became kind of a name brand recognition for a series of wry, eccentric comedies that they produced, mostly in the late 40s and 1950s. And they were the ones that did The Lady Killers, the movie that the Coen brothers remade about... a group of thieves who rent rooms from a nice old lady because it's convenient for their heist scam. And then they have to kill her, but by sheer coincidence, every single time they try, they kill themselves. Very dark, very funny. There's a film that they call The Lavender Hill Mob, which is about Alec Guinness, this very... an affable man comes up with a brilliant idea for how to steal stuff, and then he does it, and it's all very charming. The opening, he's being like interviewed, and he's talking about like how this plan came to fruition, talking about all of his great success, and there's a gag where someone just walks by and tells him how, like, just says hi to him, clearly thinks he's really, really great, and it's Audrey Hepburn. That's their only. They're barely in the movie. They got like one line. And you watch the movie now, and here's the gag: this guy is like so popular and famous or whatever that Audrey Hepburn knows who he is. That movie was made before she was a big star. She was a random attractive lady in the movie.
That's really funny.
She was cast as, and that was the original joke: is some random attractive lady finds Alec Guinness very exciting, but in actuality. Nowadays, because we know about Audrey Hepburn, the entire joke has shifted.
And now
it's this weird, wild, unexpected Audrey Hepburn cameo, and it fits the joke. It's really weird.
I forgot. I think I've been in one of the Elvis films.
Yeah. Of which there are many.
Elvis, I forgot his motivation. He wanted to be injured. I think he was trying to come up with an excuse for something. So he needed to have a limp by the time he moved to the next scene and interacted with whoever needed to. But he paid a kid that he met at the airport to kick him in the shin. It's like, kid, can you kick me? I need to have a limp. And I don't exactly remember why he needed a limp, but that was the motivation in the film. That little kid was Kurt Russell.
That's true. And Kurt Russell would go on to play Elvis multiple times.
He played Elvis in a TV movie.
Directed by John Carpenter. And then he had an uncredited role in Forrest Gump as Elvis.
And he played an Elvis impersonator in a truly terrible movie called 3,000 Miles to Graceland.
And so did Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner also played Elvis impersonator. It was about Elvis impersonators staging like a heist. It was like scuzzy and awful. And
yeah,
it's a terrible movie. Don't watch it.
They tell you never to go back. Always go back, but don't go back and assume everything's the way you left it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll see things you never noticed before. Sometimes you'll go like, oh, that movie wasn't good. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But you'll find things you missed.
Yeah.
Because the way you watch movies when you're young is different. And in the benefit of many years of context, a lot of things about that movie can change.
Mm.
A lot of things. But that's a fun question. Thank you for answering. What's our next letter? I'm waiting.
Our next letter comes from Cameron. Hello, Cameron.
Hi, Cameron.
Greetings, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. I just finished your Iron List episode on the best horror comedies of all time and was surprised at the omission of two of my favorite horror comedies.
Uh-oh, what do we do?
Which are two you have actually introduced me to. Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2, and Prom Night 3, The Last Kiss.
Oh my god, we did fuck up. we totally fucked up. Those should at least have been honorable mentions. Those movies are wonderful.
Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2 has all of the reputation. Prom Night 3 is at least as good.
Well, Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2... Let's read the email, we'll talk about those movies in a minute.
Hello, Mary Lou has a rocking horse with a human tongue, and Prom Night 3 has a scene where the main character has sex with a ghost on the American flag as the Star Spangled Banner plays in the background.
Yes.
What more could you want? I figured I'd ask a question here as well, so I'll ask, what are some of your favorite theater or / big screen experiences you've had? I recently had the pleasure of seeing George A. Romero's Once Lost the Amusement Park on the big screen here in Pittsburgh with a crowded audience, vaccination required.
I am jealous.
And it was an amazing experience. Thank you for taking the time to read this long email. I appreciate all the hours of entertainment, Cameron.
So we recently did this episode of The Iron List. It's like 2.5 hours long. And we talked about the films that we thought were the best horror comedies of all time. And somehow Whitney and I both neglected to include, even in our humble mentions, Hello Mary Lou, Prom Night 2, and Prom Night 3, The Last Kiss. These movies are wonderful, and I want to give them a moment. The first Prom Night, starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Leslie Nielsen, is an adequate slasher. It's not very interesting. Some of the writing's pretty good. I like some of the characters in it, but it's pretty much prototypical slasher territory. The sequels were some of those movies that were like not designed to be Prom Night sequels, but because they kind of revolved around a prom night, they got like turned into part of the franchise in order to sell them.
I think that was Prom Night 4, wasn't it? Repurposed?
But even 2 and 3, I think, was originally not... they didn't set out to make a sequel to Prom Night. They were going to make these horror movies.
Prom Night 3, it's the same character. So
Prom Night 2 and 3 together were like a separate idea. But this is what I heard, anyway. But all of a sudden, it's supernatural. There's a ghost haunting the high school. It was the most popular girl in school, but she's really evil. Starts infecting this Goody Two-Shoes, and... It's wild, it's creative, it's weird, and it took a long time, but eventually it found a cult audience, and people really, really respect it for being weird, at least. And it's super entertaining, you should watch it. For whatever reason, the follow-up, Prom Night 3, I think it's because it's a little less widely available, and because like the only version available is trimmed a bit. I think it got like cut down for rating or whatever. Prom Night 3 does not have the same cult. It is just as weird and fun.
It starts in hell.
It opens with Mary Lou, the villain from the original film, in hell. Like, shackled to, like, the caves of hell. And, like, listing in music with her other, like, Prom Night zombies. And then she breaks out of hell. And she, like, latches on to the cool guy at school and decides he's gonna be her new boyfriend. And when, like... A teacher gives him a bad grade. She shows up in that teacher's classroom as the waitress at an ice cream parlor, which is now there. And when he orders two ice cream cones, she takes the ice cream cones and stabs him through the hands with the pointy bits of the ice cream cones. And if you're not on board at that point, I don't know what more I can give you. I just gave you gold and you were just like, feh.
If you soak it in a special kind of sugar cement, it's sharp enough to stab.
Those movies are wonderful. Please see those movies. The other sequels are trash. They're really, really bad. They're really, really bad.
There's a 4 and... Is there a 5 as well? I don't remember.
There's a 4, there's a 5, then there's like an unofficial 6.
And there's a remake as well.
And then there's a remake, which is also really bad. It doesn't even make any sense. It's really just... Oof.
But the second part of that letter was, what are your favorite theatrical experiences? this is something we talk about from time to time. It comes up, things that we enjoy about going to a theater experience. You talked about seeing the amusement park. I imagine the audience was really into it. That's a way to, it's a fun way to sort of feed off the energy of the movie. I remember when I saw Mystery Men for the first time, I actually got to see it a few days ahead of time.
They had an early screening like week before or something.
It was like one of those early screenings here in Los Angeles. It was at the theater that's not there anymore over in Century City. Over by where the Schubert used to be.
Where they shot Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
It was shot there because it looked really futuristic. The Schubert Theater was notorious because it showed Cats. And nothing but Cats. That is the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, which wasn't just full of cats.
if it was, I would never have left.
Yeah. But there was a gigantic movie theater there. I saw Eyes Wide Shut in that theater. I saw Apocalypse Now in that theater. I got to see pretty much the premiere of this like 2,000-seat theater of Mystery Men, and everybody loved it.
Yeah.
Everybody was laughing. I was so surprised when that film bombed because it was so popular.
It's a crowd pleaser. But the trick is getting people into a theater, you know?
Yeah, it's like
the marketing doesn't work. People don't know.
It's weird in a really amusing sort of way. It's got an amazing cast. Tom Waits plays a mad scientist who lives with chickens.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a classic. I love that movie very much.
So yeah, that was a really exhilarating experience. It can be just as much fun if people don't like it. Like, there's a lot of jeering and hooting and hollering. Sometimes, you see a really bad horror movie, but it is enhanced by the fact that everybody's sort of, like, screaming and wiggling and laughing and throwing popcorn. I forgot what it was. I saw a horror movie like that, where everybody was... It wasn't a good film, but everybody was reacting very well.
One of the best theatrical experiences I've ever been to was a really unusual one. There was a special screening here in Los Angeles. And this is something that will probably only happen a couple of times and may never happen again. And I'm very fortunate that I got to experience it. It was a special presentation of Wizard People, Dear Reader.
And by Brad Neely.
Yeah, Brad Neely. Very funny comic book artist and cartoonist. Check out his stuff on YouTube. Watch the cartoon that's a music video about George Washington, and you'll get the gist. Very, very weird. Very Adult Swim. I'm a big fan.
10 stories tall, made of radiation.
He'll save children, but not the British children.
That's the Washington song. I got to see that at Spike and Mike's Sick and Twisted.
Yeah. Anyway, he had a bit that he did and was originally released online, where he was reading, like, a book on tape, a movie called Wizard People.
He was reading, it's kind of high concept.
It's super high concept.
He was reading a book on tape, but it was also meant to serve as a direct commentary track to the feature film Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
So basically what's happening is the video for Harry Potter, no audio, is the original Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, is playing, and he's doing a commentary track. And he is telling you what's happening. He's telling you the dialogue. He's telling you the plot. But he is only vaguely aware of what the plot was actually supposed to be. And he's telling you this alternate version, which is astoundingly funny. And he's... I can't even, like... I'm trying to remember. Like, Professor McGonagall becomes Professor Hardcastle McCormick.
Yeah.
Ron
Weasley becomes Ronnie the Bear. Hagrid becomes Hagar the Horrible, and he gets like passages deliberately wrong, like, and he puts Harry Potter on his motorcycle. Do you like flying on jaguars? Well, Harry says anything beats crawling, and he takes a big pull from his whiskey flask, and they fly into, like, he turns them into, like, these sort of, like, archetypal tough guys that cuss at each other.
It's absolutely hilarious. It's part, some of the jokes haven't aged well, but mostly it's really, really, really funny. I think you can still find it online. Just watch the Quidditch match, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Just watch that chapter.
Which he calls cribbage.
He calls it the game of cribbage.
Harry's practically hulking out at this point.
Harry grabs the golden snitch and says, "I am Harry fucking Potter. I am the destroyer of worlds.
I am a beautiful animal. I am Harry fucking Potter."
And at last, dear reader, the earth was silent.
It's really some of the funniest thing you'll ever see.
He did it live. They showed the movie, they turned the audio down, and Brad Neely was at a piano, and on top of the piano was like 24 beers, and he was just drinking it the entire time, getting drunker and drunker, and it was an amazing show. One of the coolest things ever. Very, very rare. Cool. Very, very rare experience. That was badass, though.
Have you ever gotten to see a silent film with live music?
I have. They used to do that at UCLA a few times. They showed a bunch of Buster Keaton shorts with a live organist. I think it might have been the same guy they usually have at the El Capitan.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's cool. That's always a treat. Let's see here. We're lucky. We live in LA. We get to have some special stuff. Mm-hmm. One time when I was in film school at UCLA, there's a theater in the film school called the James Bridges Theater, mm-hmm. and they'll have classes there, and then they'll actually ask the UCLA Film Archive. It's like, hey, could you send over a print of, I don't know, Michael Antonioni's Red Desert, and then mm-hmm. they'll show it in class and we'll talk about it. Very, very cool stuff. One day I'm leaving school and I see there's a big line around the Bridges and I'm like, what's going on? And they're like, they're showing Remains of the Day. And I'm like, and it's got this big a line? And they're like, well, Anthony Hopkins is here. So I get him.
Of course.
And Remains of the Day is playing and that movie is fucking phenomenal. And at the end, Anthony Hopkins just showed up and shot the shit for 90 minutes and it was amazing. So these things just happened.
I might have told this story before, but I've told you the Ken Russell story, right?
Yes. You told me.
We got to go to the Academy screening room here, and it's in Beverly Hills. It's actually moved to a new location. Mm-hmm. The new museum just opened up. Yeah. And I haven't been yet. But it was going to be a screening of Tommy, which Ken Russell directed, The Who's Tommy. And they sort of rewired the entire theater for sound, and Ken Russell was going to be there for a Q&A afterwards. So we all watched the movie. It's completely bananas, and everybody's sort of like, sitting back waiting to hear what this very eccentric filmmaker Ken Russell is going to say. And and he gets out and he's sitting in a chair opposite the interviewer and he is shutting him down at every available opportunity.
The interviewer, not having a conversation.
Not having a conversation, not answering the questions. It's like, how'd you like the movie? He's good. Okay. How did you get the cast together? Oh, you hire actors. Okay. And eventually, it came to the point where he's like, he even says, you're not giving me anything. Well, oh, good. Like, he's clearly shutting this guy down.
Like, he's doing it on purpose.
And we weren't sure, like, what's going on here? And he finally just kind of put the button on the whole conversation and said, you know, directing's very easy. The beginning of a scene, you say action. At the end, you say cut. And that's directing. Thank you, Ken Russell.
Thank you, Ken. That explains how the Devils happened.
Yeah, the director of the Devils and Lair of the White Worm.
Just sort of
and other
came
weird
to work
besides.
And said action and cut, and somehow that happened. Sure. Whatever you say.
And we left completely baffled, and we didn't learn until later that that was an act of revenge.
Yeah.
We learned that he had been asked to, he lives in England, or lived in England, he's passed away now, but he was living in England at the time, and they said, why don't you come out, stay here a couple days, and you can do this Q&A, and he said, okay. And where are you going to put me up? What hotel am I staying in? And they said, well, we know you have family nearby, just stay with them. And he said, fuck you.
It's pretty presumptuous.
You're not going to pay for a hotel. I'm not going to ask my family. That's
very presumptuous.
Imposing.
You assume that that's okay.
You are now imposing on my family.
Yeah.
And that's not okay for you to do. So that was what he did. I think they ended up paying for a hotel. I don't remember what the actual
detail
was.
Too late at
that
point.
But he was so pissed off. That was the Q&A he gave. Wow. The worst Q&A imaginable.
That's amazing.
It was great.
Good for him. One last one and then we'll move on. Mm-hmm. A movie I never thought I'd get to see on the big screen. And about 10 years ago, a mutual friend of ours had a birthday and they knew people who worked at the New Beverly Cinema before Quentin Tarantino bought it. And
I've heard of that place.
And they finagled a midnight screening of Rockula. And if anyone knows me, if you've heard me talk about it, Rockula is one of my favorite movies. Is it one of the best movies I've ever seen? No. Is it one of my favorites? Yes. It is a very funny, very silly comedy starring Dean Cameron as a vampire whose true love, he meets his true love, and then 2 weeks later, she is always killed by a pirate with a rhinestone peg leg. And this happens over and over again. She's repeatedly reincarnated, and it's been going on for centuries, and he's getting really pissed off about it. And this time she's a pop star, and in order to woo her, he starts a vampire-themed rock band called Rockula. Full of great cameos, the music's really catchy and fun, but it barely got released when it initially came out. Doesn't have much of a cult. I really didn't think I'd ever get to see it on the big screen. But I did. That was awesome. And on top of that, Dean Cameron was there. I idolized Dean Cameron as a child. Between Rockula, the original Ski School, and Summer School, Dean Cameron was like my Zac Efron. Like, he was a big deal to me. And he was a very, very nice guy. And at the Q&A afterwards, he was initially very self-effacing. And what we found out was he thought we were all here to make fun of the movie. And he was a good sport about it. Uh-huh. And he was like, oh, okay, that's what happened to Rockula. Shame, but okay. And then while he's giving this self-effacing thing about making this stupid movie, a friend of mine named Brian gets up in the audience and says, hey, Dean, stop kicking my puppy, dude. And Dean Cameron stopped and he realized, oh, everyone here actually likes it unironically. And he totally changed his demeanor, and then he wrote a blog post about it, about how it made him feel better to know that this movie he made, that he actually put a lot into, is now appreciated, and it made him, it kind of changed his view on it, and it was really, really sweet. So that was a really heartwarming one. So there you go. Yeah, that was nice. I like that memory. All right, well, we should move on, though. Right, but thank you for the great trip down memory lane.
Here is a letter from Sean. Hello, Sean. Greetings and humble salutations, Mr. McCool and Hot Men Bibs. Hotman Bibs.
Hotman. That's from Avatar The Last Airbender in the Fire Nation. Everyone says Hotman.
Do they?
Yeah. They say, that's what you say instead of Sir. Hotman.
Hotman. Okay.
I don't know if that's what they're referencing, but that's what I'm
at. I think it is, because I think they're going to bring up Avatar. But I've been a fan of you both since I stumbled across the B-Movies podcast, and I've followed you both ever since. Oh, well, thank you for following us all this way. Both your perspectives have really opened up the way I consume media as an art form, and really helped increase my intake of independent film. While I do disagree with some of your criticisms, one of you more than the other, I won't say which would be rude to Whitney. Thank you.
It's a lot of people who are the exact opposite. There's a lot of people who are the exact opposite. It's fair.
I don't want people to agree with me. I just want people to listen. I've never found those disagreements to be unfounded, and they have really helped my hone my views on things I love, and for that I am eternally grateful. I just got done with the mailbag episode in which you discussed your favorite episodes of television, and I'm sure Bibbs already knows from my greeting, but I cannot express how happy I am that Avatar, The Last Airbender, was included in the discussion.
Yay!
I was 19 when the show was released, and it has been a real struggle to convince my friends how amazing the show actually is. Bibbs' choices of Tales of Ba Sing Se and Appa's Lost Days are beautiful. I don't know if I ever cried harder at a TV show than when I did when Iroh started singing a song to his son.
That's right.
I would also throw in Zuko Alone, Sokka's Master, and The Storm as truly remarkable storytelling.
Those are also really good episodes,
But the episode that really sticks out to me is The Old Masters. This is the second episode of the four-part finale, and I truly feel that it is an amazing episode in the middle of what I believe is one of the greatest conclusions to a TV show of all time. Zuko's reunion with Iroh is touching and beautiful, and Aang's literal internal battle at the idea of taking a life is something I think everyone should see.
Yeah.
But since my friends and I were basically adults when this came out, most of my friends don't believe me when I talk about a Nicktoon being one of the best TV shows of all time. It was a Nickelodeon thing? I know it was.
It was on Nickelodeon,
And that got me wondering, has that ever happened to you? Have either of you ever come across something that was perhaps made for children that you came across in your adulthood that you found to be truly great, and how did you convince other people to give it a shot? Thank you both for everything you do. I'm looking forward to your full Avatar discussion when Whitney finally watches the show. Please, Whitney, I know you're busy, but we need this. Yours truly, Sean.
I'll probably put that on a poll after we're done with our Patreon work through Batman, the 1960s. But those are indeed wonderful things. To answer your question, what did you do when you discovered something as an adult that you wanted people to see that they might not otherwise have been into because it seems childish or weird? The answer is we have these podcasts.
That's kind of what we do.
That's a reason to become a critic is to want to share art with people and try to encourage people to see things they might not otherwise have, and maybe see the value in things that they might otherwise have been shut off to for one reason or another. Growing up, I would see the value in a lot of art, often child art, because that's what I was, not child art, but like art geared towards kids.
Art, art, art,
Or for younger demographics.
I don't even want to say for kids. I just want to say that acceptable for kids.
I would say art aimed at kids. It's because of the fact that Avatar, you said it yourself, Avatar was on Nickelodeon. Mm-hmm. Nickelodeon is the self-described kids network.
Yeah.
It's not unreasonable. It's not unreasonable for adults to think that if it's on Nickelodeon, it's just for kids. Mm-hmm. I think that's closed-minded, but it's not entirely an unreasonable assumption because that's what the branding suggests. And I think it is up to critics to take it upon themselves when they see, to A, give everything a chance, and B, when they see something that is genuinely great, regardless of where it comes from or what its pedigree is, to stand up for it and try to make sure people know about it. This is one of the things, reasons why I love the ending of the movie Ratatouille.
Yeah.
Where Anton Ego, who is seen as a very, very tough critic, comes to the realization, more of a reminder that although it's fair and fun and certainly reasonable and part of the job to be a critic, it is incredibly important for critics to champion the new and to make sure that people know that art can come from unlikely places.
Yes.
And so you may not think a Nickelodeon animated series about martial arts and like fire powers and water powers could be genuinely profound, but it can be. And this one is. And we want you to see it. We want you to appreciate it. We want you to experience the profound emotions that we got out of it. And that's one of the reasons why I do what I do. So that I can stand up for something like Psycho Goreman and say I actually got a lot out of this weird fucking movie that no one's gonna, I know a lot of people who wouldn't see it because it's called Psycho Goreman. I want you to see Psycho Goreman.
Psycho Goreman is wonderful. Yeah. It's goopy and strange. Yeah.
And that's for adults purely. It's not quite the same conversation, but that's the first thing that came to mind like recently that I'm like, I'm a huge champion for Psycho Goreman.
I learned recently that one of the Red Letter Media guys is in Psycho Goreman.
Oh.
Rich Evans is his name. And do you remember the vat of human body parts?
Yes, I do.
He plays the voice of that thing.
Oh, that's nice.
Like it screams at one point and just goes, ah! That was this guy Rich Evans from Red Letter Media.
Good for him. Good gig if you can get it.
Yeah, there are things that I've encountered. You know, I'm just going to keep on getting older, but I'm going to keep on consuming things for any type of whatever the planned audience is going
to
be.
You never know. You never know where good stuff's going to come. Someone has to look.
It's every once in a while I'll come upon something that I wish I had when I was younger. Yeah. I feel that way about Invader Zim.
Yeah, same.
Which was an animated show from
also Nickelodeon.
A Nickelodeon show from the early 2000s. It was done by an incredibly twisted comic book artist named Jonan Vasquez, and and we've talked about it on this show on a podcast before about it. It's about the world's worst space invader. He's so bad. He's like foiled his species invasion plans in the past. He belongs to a species of conquerors that they sort of randomly choose this planet that they have no interest in and tell him, go conquer it yourself just to get him out of the way.
Yeah. Just go on, and then we'll never see you again.
And wouldn't you know it, that planet is Earth, but it's not Earth. It's like this dark carnival version of Earth.
Yeah.
Where, like, he goes to, and he has to pose as an elementary school student, and nobody...
Because he's very small, so it's the only thing that makes sense,
But it's this twisted world where there's an episode where he's distressed that he has to go see the school nurse, but he doesn't have internal organs like other human children.
So he thinks he's going to be found out.
So he thinks he's going to be found out, so he stalks the school with alien devices, stealing organs out of other kids' bodies, like multiple lungs and many hearts, and he just starts eating
them. At the end of the episode, he's like gigantic, and organs are falling out of his mouth as he talks. It's really gross.
And he passes his physical. It's a sick show. I think my description of that episode elucidates
That may be the most twisted episode, but it's really good. It's really good.
Well, the one where he turns another character into a baloney is also pretty twisted. Wait a minute. I'm delicious.
Gaz, taste me. I'm delicious.
I was a weird little kid. I liked weird shit, and that's something that totally would have been my jam if I had run into it when I was like 10.
Yeah, that's how I feel about Gravity Falls, and lately it's how I really feel about The Owl House, which is currently going, I think it was supposed to be 3 or 4 seasons, but Disney in their finite wisdom decided to cancel it. They're going to let the story end, but they're going to do like a truncated 3rd season apparently. But The Owl House is about a teen girl. Who a teen bisexual girl, which is cool. Like, she's got crushes on multiple people, and that's actually discussed in the show.
Oh, good.
It's not the talked about a lot, but she's got a crush on a girl, and then she starts having more of a crush on a guy, and it's totally fine, and that's really, really great. Would have been great to have that normalized when I was a kid. She ends up in this, like, following an owl through a magical door, and that magical door is in a land full of magic and wonder where everything's kind of fucked up. Like, they live on a giant, like a gigantic, like, deity, basically, that died. And so, like, where do you live? I live on the toenail. Like, that's...
Jeez, all right.
She ends up working for, apprenticing under a witch who's, like, an absolute outcast and pariah. And, wonderful stories, really, really clever, great bit of mythos, but it's sweet in unexpected ways. It earns all of its drama. I love its queerness. It's really, really great. I don't know where it's going. I mean, maybe it could let me down in the end, but, like, so far it's really, really good, and I do hope more people see it and show Disney how wrong they were.
I like that her sexuality is discussed. Like, remember when there was a minor stir when Loki...
Yeah,
had like an illusion. It's like, oh yes, I've messed around with men and women, and that was the last you heard.
Well,
of
again,
it.
Just it's a kid's show allegedly, but like the only love interest she's had for most of it is a girl.
Okay,
awesome. Mm. And it's like teen stuff. They're all like too embarrassed to say anything, and you're waiting for the declaration of love. But
yeah, just like
it's
cute,
clear,
little,
like
there's
a whole storyline that's all about some monster that'll take the form of what scares you, and this girl who has a crush on our protagonist is if you didn't know it before, you know it in this episode, because they're afraid to face this monster, because what's going to come out is they're afraid to ask the protagonist to prom. So this is as openly queer as I've ever seen a kid's show.
All right.
And it's really great, and on top of that, it's really great. It's good representation, and it's really, really great.
Uh-huh.
That's awesome. I really wish I could have had that when I was a kid. Seriously, if you like Gravity Falls, if you like Avatar The Last Airbender, see The Owl House. It's really wonderful. You can find it on Disney Plus. Check it out. And I'm sure there's more stuff we're missing besides, but just off the top of our heads. We should move on, but hopefully that helps some people find some cool shows. And thank you for writing in. I'm glad we have a kindred.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Paula. Hello, Paula.
Hi, Paula.
Hey, guys. I was just listening to your Cancel Too Soon episode on Dark Intruder.
Oh, yeah.
At work. And you said something about Leslie Nielsen's character making reference to the gods that Lovecraft made up, specifically mentioning Dagon as the example. Now, I don't know much of anything about H.P. Lovecraft, but I do know a tiny bit about ancient gods. And funnily enough, Dagon was actually a real god that people worshipped once upon a time.
You are right about that, and I was wrong. Thank you for bringing this up. I yield the floor.
Yeah, there's a little bit here.
I wasn't thinking about that.
Dagon is referenced in the Christian Bible. When the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant from Israel, they place it in Dagon's temple. Mm. Anyway, all of this ran through my head in about 2 seconds, and rather than let it go and continue through my day, I decided to stop the podcast, stop working, and email you this admittedly trivial piece of information, like the true nerd that I am. Bless you all.
Thank you.
I hope that this didn't come off as nitpicking.
No.
Please
educate.
If there's nits, pick them.
Yeah.
I hope this didn't come off as nitpicking or a fact checking to you. It was just a random useless fact that I wanted to share. Anyway, keep up the good work. Cancel Too Soon is still my favorite podcast. I've listened to every episode multiple times.
Wow.
And you guys still manage to make me laugh every time. All the best, Paula.
Thank you, Paula. So two things with this. One, yes, I knew that in the back of my head, and I'll explain why I veered towards Lovecraft instead of talking about the original mythology in a moment. But one thing I did read once, and I wish I could cite specifically so this would sound more scholarly as opposed to... It's true, I read that once. Mm-hmm. I had read somewhere that the reason why in the Bible, in the Ten Commandments, there is a commandment about how you're not allowed to make graven images.
Yes.
And when you read it just flat, without context, it looks like it's basically saying you're not allowed to draw a fish. You may make no images of that which is under the sea or something to that effect.
Okay.
And it seems like if you've drawn a fish, you're going to hell. Like, that's when I was a kid. That's when I read it. And apparently that's because Dagon was very popular.
Yeah.
And it was very specifically trying to outlaw these competitive religions.
Mm.
Which... raises some questions about how insecure God was feeling that day, but
if you read, go through the, I'm not no biblical scholar, yeah. but I know that if you go through the Old Testament, there are a lot of sort of the stringent rules about, how certain religious sects ought to behave are very much about, they're not about appeasing God. They're about, maintaining the tribe. And they're about sort of keeping the tribe together. A lot of sort of, and we're still living this down today, a lot of sort of the anti-sex rhetoric that people like to sort of nitpick out of the Bible. Don't do that kind of nitpicking, by the way. All comes from this, a misconception that human sperm was a limited resource.
Yeah, they just didn't understand how science worked.
They didn't know that. They thought you would run out. So if you have too much sex, you cannot propagate. And
it was seen as practical advice.
It was practical advice. And especially if, life expectancy was much lower then, it was actually much harder to survive then. So propagation was actually really important to keeping the tribe alive.
Yeah, we need to
keeping
have as many kids as
the
possible.
The village around,
a
lot of kids. So don't have a lot of extramarital sex, only have sex within the tribe.
Yeah. That's true for a lot of things in the Bible.
We know different now. Stop putting your sexual hang-ups on religion. And stop using religion to justify sexual hang-ups.
Context was everything.
Context was everything. I didn't know that about Dagon.
I've read that before in reasonably scholarly sources, like histories of...
I have no reason not to believe you on that.
And I didn't mean to be pithy about religion. I mean, I have my own beliefs or whatever. But, literally, if you read the Bible, there are lines from God where God says, "I am a jealous God." They literally say that.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. If you're the one true God, it raises questions, right? Mm. That always weirded me out. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. Mm. But that's the thing. Totally true. The reason why I veered towards describing as Lovecraftian, and I mentioned Dagon because Dagon is more well known, but Leslie Nielsen also name drops Azathoth, which is a Lovecraftian creation.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure the writers were mostly getting it from Lovecraft, but clearly Lovecraft got it from some sort of research he had done at some point.
Yeah.
So yes, thank you for the moment down history lane. It's important to remember that as influential and as artistically significant as Lovecraft is, he was also a racist asshole.
Oh,
so
golly, yes.
If we can take away a little credit from him, I'm fine with that. let's just remove that one thing.
Don't look up the name of his cat.
Anyway, moving on.
Here's a letter from Adelaide. Hello, Cenobibs and Withead.
Ooh,
or Cenobites. I love Hellraiser so much.
I know you do.
I just finished listening to your Iron List episode on horror comedies, and I had a recommendation I wanted to give both of you, but also a general question beyond that.
Okay.
First, let me tell you about a film so incredulous that Ronald Reagan supposedly tried to have it destroyed. Dude Bro Party Massacre 3. Is the first. I haven't seen this.
I've heard about this.
It's the first and only installment of a franchise about a fraternity who fight a continuing family tree of serial killers that all go by the moniker Motherface. It features insanely fun kills, ridiculous characters that make sense within the universe, and a genuine loving send-up to 1980s horror and all of its feats and faults. It's my second favorite horror comedy ever. If it sounds even slightly intriguing, I highly recommend it. I've heard mixed things about Dude Bro Party Massacre.
Yeah, I know some people who love it. I know some people who aren't fans.
I've heard it called a really good horror comedy, and some people have described it as one of the worst, which means it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I always got the impression that, The impression I got from other people was that some people thought it was trying too hard to be
shocking.
Shocking or, trauma-esque or whatever and didn't, whatever. But that doesn't mean it's bad. I have not gotten around to that. I really do need to one of these days. I know a lot of people who really, really are fond of it. It's got Greg Sestero and Patton Oswalt and Nina Hartley.
How bad
could it be?
Nina Hartley, the porn star.
Yep. Legendary Nina Hartley. Mm.
And Patton Oswalt as well.
Yeah.
and Greg Sestero, who we all know him as the star of Retro Puppet Master.
Yes.
He's done nothing else of note.
Nothing else of
note. No, he's the guy from The Room.
Yeah, and he was almost in that one Malcolm in the Middle episode. Anyway, moving on.
Beyond that, though, I wanted to know how you normally go about recommending people movies.
Hmm.
Beyond your podcasts.
Mm.
When you meet new people or have friends ask you for movie recommendations, do you have go-to general picks that fit most people?
Mm.
I almost always immediately jump to Some Like It Hot, A Monster Calls, and Your Name. I'm really curious your thoughts and answers. Sincerely yours, Adelaide.
That's a good point. And as when you tell people, when you meet people or whatever, and they and you, the people ask, like, what do you do? And you get to say you're a film critic. Usually, there is an immediate follow-up question, and I always wonder if other jobs get this. It'd be like, oh, I'm a film critic. Oh, really? What's your favorite movie? I wonder if other jobs like, oh, what are you? I'm a doctor. Oh, really? What's your favorite disease?
Well, we're critics. we respond to art. You would ask a food critic what their favorite food might be.
Of course I would. But yeah. I would ask, if I met a food critic, I'd be like, hey, where should I be eating right now? Like, what's you're in LA? Tell me what's good. And I jest. It's very natural. There's usually two questions. It's either who are some of your favorite movies or filmmakers, because you're just sort of testing out the critic to see if the recommendations are going to fit your taste.
Yeah.
Very reasonable. I'm not offended by it. Very, very cool. Or what's good lately?
Yeah.
Is often very, very common. And that's why, usually that's what I veer towards, is what's recent, what's novel. They're likely not to have seen it. And I usually go with, if I have some sense of their taste and there's something I can think of that fits it, I'll go there. But usually I'll just go with whatever excites me.
Yeah.
So like recently, for example, I would say, hey, if you love horror and comedy, you should see Werewolves Within. That movie is amazing. And if you're really, if you don't mind if it gets really, really gory, see Psycho Goreman. I hate to bring it up all the time, but there you go. Oh, do you like, are you from L.A.? You should see Summertime.
See Summertime for sure. Summertime That's one of the best movies of this year.
It's a beautiful film about Los Angeles and poetry and young people trying to express themselves in really powerful ways. It's incredibly inventive and soulful, and there's really nothing else like it right now. And I love it to pieces. Please go see that. Looking for something to see with your kids? Have you seen Mitchells versus the Machines, right? Because Mitchells versus the Machines is not only very fun and full of exciting like moments in action and comedy, but it's actually very intelligent and it's got really good representation for the most part. And it's absolutely a treat, and it's way better than you'd expect an animated movie to be right now.
It's a Lovecraftian demon in the form of a giant Furby. It's really wonderful.
I forgot about that for a second.
Dark harvest begin.
So yeah, I usually lean towards something recent unless they ask for something else, but usually I go for something that recently came out so that it will be new to them.
I had a conversation like this with some of my friends who work in a video store up at Cinephile Video, and if you work in a video store, you get it all the time. What's your favorite movie?
Yeah.
And
I fucking dare you.
Yeah, rather than just sort of shrug and say, I don't know.
I'm imagining like two video store clerks like in like Drip Along Daffy, like walking down the middle of the road in like the western town, you know, sun going down, the clock ticking, and then when they finally get to the town square, what's your favorite movie? Oh, shit.
Bam, Tokyo Story. If you work in a video store, you learn to sort of be a little bit more tactful about it. You don't just sort of shrug and say, I don't know, I got so many.
People want to talk about movies.
Yeah.
And they probably don't get to, which is why they're trying to engage with you.
So they usually try to get something out of the customer.
Like, you probably like stuff.
What are you looking for tonight? What are some of your favorite films? I can recommend something along those lines. But sometimes you get a really hard-nosed customer who's really going to press. Like, no, what's your favorite? Like, you have one. What is it? It's like above all others. And so they usually, at that point, they have one like in their back pocket. That is a film they like. It's not necessarily going to be their favorite every day.
No, that's how life works.
So somebody like even asked me when I was in the video store, what's your favorite movie? And I just said, Persona. Ingmar Bergman's film, Persona. Very good movie. I love it. Is it my favorite movie? I have a lot of favorite movies.
Sure.
I have a lot of movies.
I have one.
There are great movies, and I enjoy great movies. And I remember...
You don't have to be monogamous with the movie you like. You can like as many movies as you want.
You feel that way when you're like in high school. It's like this is my favorite. This is mine. This is the one that defines me.
I keep it in my locker. You know,
this is always going to be number one on my list.
Yeah, I define myself by my love for this movie. Yeah, I also like... Oh, shit. I also like this movie. Damn it. Yeah.
I had an experiment once and it completely failed, but I thought that I could guess somebody's age and sort of like the path they were on to discovering movies, depending what their top 10 looked like, because I found that a lot of people in their 20s were discovering older movies for the first time in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
So their top 10s usually included like four movies from the last year, like a few like cult classics they had just seen for the first time, and like two really old classics,
like Ringers. You know, like, oh, I only just saw something like it now. Oh, I only just saw for the first time Frankenstein. So Frankenstein.
Like a couple of years ago, somebody said, "Oh, Good Night and Good Luck" was one of my favorite movies. They had just seen it like last year, and they had never seen a movie like that before.
It might be your favorite thing. You might actually be that, but it's also potentially some recency bias slipping in there. You know?
Yeah, but so. Having like one with a bullet was sort of anathema to working in a video store. But they always had one just in case they had the hard-nosed customer. I always said persona. Roger Ebert got this question a lot. He always said La Dolce Vita. That was his back pocket film. It's like, what's your favorite movie of all time? La Dolce Vita. What does that mean? Your favorite film? One you want to watch at any time? Mm-hmm. I mean, cause you get a lot of different things for a lot of different movies. When it comes to recommending things, like if somebody says what's good, I do what you do. I try to think of things I've enjoyed recently.
Yeah.
If they say, like, sometimes I get this question, what's something I need to see?
Oh.
Not, like, recently, like, to be a good, like, film person.
Yeah, what's important to see? In order to be well-read, well-viewed, whatever.
And then you can, like, snap out with, like, a grand classic that maybe not everybody's seen. Have you seen 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yeah.
See 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, it's part of the cinematic vernacular at this point. Yeah. Even if it's not your favorite thing, you'll understand other movies well now because it's such a lodestone for the medium. That's a good one too. Another one I get a lot of is, what's a great movie I haven't seen?
That's a tough one.
And that's a tough one because you don't know what they've seen. You don't know what they've sought out.
I immediately come back and ask, what have you seen?
Exactly. But like, you know, that's the whole thing. It's like they're looking for something to unearth a treasure, you know? But I don't know how deeply they've looked. Usually I find if they're asking that question, they probably haven't looked that deeply. Because if they have, they probably have other resources to find recommendations for things. And they're not necessarily laying it all on me. But so you usually don't have to dig too hard to find an interesting like cult film to recommend them.
Yeah.
But like even then I do try to think about it or whip out something weird. Like, hey, have you seen the Australian 1980s crime comedy Malcolm? It's about an eccentric inventor who gets roommates who are bank robbers, and he builds a little robot to help them rob banks, and it's really cute.
And I've been on podcasts before, and I admit the temptation to skew weird hits real hard in those situations, especially when you have several other co-hosts who recommend really well-known things.
Yeah,
I was on a podcast recently for IGN. Specifically for IGN Africa.
That's so really cool.
So I'm on a podcast in Africa. If you're in South Africa, you can probably find me. But they asked, like, what's a good horror movie for the Halloween season? What's, like, something scary? And somebody said, oh, I like The Exorcist. Yes, I like The Exorcist. I like The Shining, too. Oh, also I like The Shining. I recommended Basket Case 2, which is a little bit off the beaten path. I mean, horror hounds know that movie.
People don't need us. Again, it's... To remind us that the classic movies are classic is very reasonable and fine. Mm-hmm. And if someone says, hey, what are some of the best haunted house movies ever made? Yeah, The Shining's going to be on that list. But you don't need me to affirm that. Mm-hmm. It will happen because it's just that good, but you don't need me to do that. The best thing I can do as a critic is to, when you give me a platform, to tell people about movies that actually could use a platform.
Yeah.
The Shining doesn't need one right now. It may come a day when it does again, but right now it doesn't. This is the time for Basket Case 2. Because if one person listens to that podcast and goes, oh, I guess I need to see that, and then does, you really did your job that day.
Yeah.
And that's great. But I think we have time for one more.
Okay. Here is a letter from Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, I am interested in the clothesline analogy of plot. This is something
I made up. Yeah, I like this.
The idea that the plot of the movie is like a clothesline on which you hang quilts. We come to see the quilts and not the clothesline. This was pretty much the same attitude taken by mystery writer and occasional screenwriter Raymond Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
A good plot was one which produced good scenes. You didn't need to have to wait till you got to the solution of a mystery novel before you could enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You should be able to enjoy the journey as much as, if not more so, than the destination. Mm-hmm. He believed a good mystery was one in which you could read even if you knew that the ending was missing.
Yeah.
Mystery of Edward Drood. This Dickens' unfinished novel.
Yeah.
In his early novels, his method of plotting was to cobble together two or three short stories he'd written together for pulp magazines, connecting them in ways that usually didn't make much sense, but he didn't care as long as he got good scenes out of it.
Yeah.
Also, Alfred Hitchcock never seemed to care too much about plots. He believed in the gimmick of the movie, which he called the MacGuffin, popular. I don't think he invented the term.
No.
I think that's, it's misattributed, I think.
Yeah, but maybe.
But the thing was that the thing that everyone was chasing after and was wanting to kill or die for was not that important. The only thing that mattered was that the audience was able to believe that it was important to the people on the screen.
Exactly.
It didn't have to be important to the audience. The audience didn't even have to understand it as long as they were able to believe that it's something important to the people up on the screen, and that was enough.
Yeah, if you have a good setup for your movie and it gets people out of the house and doing something unexpected, that's all you really need. Yeah.
I remember critics saying about the Marvel movies, the only exposition I need for these movies is for someone to say, okay, you see this? This is the cube. Everybody wants the cube. Everyone is after the cube. Got it? Go.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah. Also, the director of Can You Ever Forgive Me, the Melissa McCarthy movie, said that when it came time to cut down the running time of a movie, this is when you normally cut out scenes that didn't have much to do with the plot. There's a sweet scene in which Melissa McCarthy, her character, went to a smoky dive in Manhattan and listened to a drag queen singing a torch song. It didn't have anything to do with the plot, so it could go. But she kept it in because she reasoned that the audiences don't really remember the plots. They remember scenes like this one.
Yeah.
So how important is plot? What are examples of movies in which twists and turns and surprises in the plot offered pleasures to the audience? I saw Diabolique for the first time with an audience at the Stanford Theater in Palo Alto. The audience made that satisfying ah sound, or maybe it's like oh sound for that movie. But the surprise came at the end, which surprised me because I thought the movie had been around long enough that everyone already knew the surprise. I certainly knew it. I won't reveal it because apparently some people still don't know it. This is Alan signing off.
Alan, thanks for bringing this up. And yeah, Winnie, I don't know how long you've been working on it, but you've got a great analogy there.
Yeah.
And we were talking, I think we were talking about Dune. And
we were talking about, I got some heat for sort of fudging through a lot of the details of Shang-Chi.
That's what we were talking about.
And I got some details, slightly wrong.
Yeah. I still haven't seen it, so I can't say. When I see that movie, and I will, I'm looking forward to it. It's see it in the theater. When I see that movie, I will go back and listen to our podcast, and I will promise you,
You're going to correct what I got.
I'll see how bad it really was.
My theory is that, and as my analogy points to, that plot is relatively unimportant to most movies. Sure, when you're watching something like Diabolique that has like twists in it, a big surprise. Yeah. I saw a movie just the other day called Creepy by Kiyoshi Kurosawa.
Yeah, you go, yeah.
And that has a few surprises along the way. And having those surprises revealed to you, these twists in the plot, are an important part of sort of staying engaged with that. But most films don't have that. And when you are recounting a film back to somebody, or when you're describing a film, or when you're thinking about it, unless it's something that's a really impressive plot twist or something you really didn't see coming, you're probably not thinking about the plot. You're thinking about fun character moments.
Exactly.
You're thinking about sets. You're thinking about an action set piece, perhaps, or an emotional moment or a speech. The plot is the thing that functions to string those things together, but those are what the film is really about.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I get to the plot details wrong in Shang-Chi, it's because I don't find that to be totally relevant to the things that are more important to me.
I would argue, I will say this as a counterpoint to that. I would argue that as a critic, it is our responsibility not to get things like that wrong.
This is true.
And
if
I were your editor again and you sent me a review and I found out that you've gotten plot points wrong, I would at the very least, I would hopefully catch them beforehand. But I would, at the very least, if we said, "Hey, we made a correction to this thing. It mischaracterized or said the wrong name or whatever like that," and that would be fine. And that would be that. These things happen. That's not the end of the world. Because you didn't like ruin anyone's life or anything. You got a name wrong or whatever, so it's not a big deal. Regardless, I really like this metaphor, and I was thinking about this a lot when I was watching Dune, the new Dune. Is the second live-action feature film adaptation. I haven't seen the TV miniseries. And we were talking about how David Lynch's film makes the plot seem incomprehensible, but is incredibly enveloping in its sense of place and its sense of mysticism and mystery. And it's really
weird imagery, aliens, technologies.
It's all about how strange and alien this thing is. And the Denis Villeneuve version focuses so much on the plot that the plot is now 100% clear. I can tell you everything that happens in that movie.
but it's somehow a lot less interesting now.
Yeah, because
isn't it?
All of the things that aren't the plot are gone.
Yeah.
And I was having a conversation with someone, and I was explaining this, and they were like, well, what about the palm trees? There's two fucking lines of dialogue about why we have palm trees. Mm. That's not the same thing. And when you think, and the Can You Ever Forgive Me example is a really, really good one, where, again, the plot of that movie is clear. You don't need that much to convey the plot of this movie about a woman who is she's an author whose books aren't selling, and she's really in like a bad place financially, and she discovers that
she can forge letters.
Yeah,
very
there's
well,
a secondary market for like old letters from like famous people, and as someone who's written a lot of history books, she can do that very well. And so she ends up starting to sell forged, just correspondence from one person to another. Mm. And it seems like you're just sort of bilking this like these like rich schmoes who have way too much time and money on their hands. And it seems like a relatively harmless crime. But it adds up.
Yeah.
And it ends up, you know, kind of taking over their life. And it becomes, it's a really good movie. It grew on me more and more over time. But yeah, the plot's not the thing that I remember. What I remember about that movie is the relationship between Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant.
Mm.
That's what I remember. That's what counts.
Yeah.
But there are movies that do care about plot. And I find that when I, as a critic, am focusing on plot, I may make an aside, this doesn't make sense or whatever like that. But if I'm really focusing on plot, it's because the movie wasn't giving me something interesting enough that I had anything else to do with my mind.
Yeah.
If all I'm doing is thinking about your plot, A, your plot had better fucking work. Mm. If it doesn't, if it's not like absolutely razor sharp your plot and that's all you're giving us, you're doing it wrong. But if the characters aren't interesting enough, if the experiences that they're going in is interesting enough, if the ideas that you're playing with aren't interesting enough, that all I can think about is literally what's happening, and then I start asking myself, am I buying this? Does it have its own internal logic? Then that's, you've basically stripped away everything else in the movie I could care about. And that's not a good place to be.
It's the least interesting way to look at a film, I think. This idea of like sort of connecting, this is something you see in a lot of conversations about like the big blockbuster films, big superhero films. Like, this is how this connects to these other characters, and just like a little reference they did to this. This is not encouraging like a critical thinking. This is not talking about sort of the tone or what these films are about at all.
Yeah.
It's just talking about the structure. That's what people are getting really excited about, is the structure of these films. I think a good example of what I'm talking about is the James Bond movies. Specifically, some of the earlier ones.
Yeah, the more travel-luggy kind of deals,
Specifically not Casino Royale, because that actually has a really tight script.
Yeah.
A lot of the scripts in the James Bond movies feel like a couple of different scripts sneezed into a bowl.
Yeah.
You don't know why James Bond is in this country. You don't know what this opera is that he's attending. You don't know the lady spy that he's supposed to meet there.
Yeah.
Like, it's been vaguely sketched out at MI6.
Yeah.
But then he ends up like globe trekking to another location. You're not exactly sure what he's looking for in that scene. It doesn't matter.
Why are
really.
We there so we can see that?
We're there because we want to see James Bond in a nice suit, drinking a nice drink in quote exotic location.
A good example of this is A Spy Who Loved Me, which has this big, incredible, like weird orchestra opera thing at the pyramids in Egypt, and there's a light show and everything.
Do you remember why he was seeing this opera?
I couldn't tell you that if you put a gun to my head.
Yeah.
But I remember that sequence, because that is different. I have not seen that. And it's just him fighting a guy to the death on the side, and I'm like, cool. That's why we're there.
Who was that guy? Why was he there?
Doesn't
what was he there
matter.
For? None of that stuff matters.
Yeah. Everyone
really think
knows
about
the
stuff.
Scene from North by Northwest where Cary Grant is chased by a crop duster. Why? Because it's unique. It's distinctive. It's very threatening. Can you imagine if someone in a biplane just tried to mow you down and like grind you up in the propeller, even though that would kill the pilot?
No,
the thing would crash. But it makes no sense
at all. That said, you know, you do need something to hang this on. I think that's the function of the plot, is to make sure
it
looks like there's a story happening, or it looks a little bit like real life. It was just a bunch of like unconnected action sequences. That might serve a function, but it wouldn't feel quite the same.
It wouldn't feel like a linear narrative. It wouldn't feel like we've accomplished anything, or the people have grown a little bit.
There wouldn't have been sort of that change, but most importantly, it would affect pacing.
Yeah.
We can't have just action scene after action scene. We'd get exhausted.
Yeah, I've seen movies that are nothing but wall-to-wall action, and they're fun for a while, but you can only keep that up for so long before you need to take a break and tell me something new. Because at this point, you're just fighting, and I forgot why.
To quote one of my favorite authors, Daniel Pinkwater, it's like eating five of the best pieces of chocolate cake you've ever had. You just can't handle number six.
Yeah. Yeah. After a while, you need something else. Yeah, exactly. And pacing is a really important thing, and plot can be really, really useful for that. Mm. It can be useful to take a breather, talk about some stuff.
But there are plenty of movies that don't have, like, a conventional plot or even story, as it were. The films of Jacques Tati are an excellent example of this, where people are just sort of having tiny little mini-stories throughout, these, like, amusing little life's moments. Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, he goes on holiday. That's the story.
Yeah.
He just goes to a beach resort and spends some time
there.
But
it moves forward in time. It drives us forward. We're going somewhere. Yeah. And that's something that movies take place in time. It's something you can't take away from them. Books don't. Books are static. But when you're watching a movie, it flows. And you can adjust that flow if you really want to. You want to fast forward or whatever like that. But, like, generally speaking, you're just following something in time. And to maintain the audience's attention over a long period of time, we're easily distracted animals. Mm. We're constantly looking for stimuli. That's what we do. We're coming up within our own head. We're, like, watching TV while we're on our phone, while we're listening to music. Like, it's ridiculous. We're looking for stuff. We're voraciously consuming ideas and information and entertainment and stimuli. Mm. So if your art takes place over amount of time, you need to keep our attention over however long your fucking movie is. 2 hours. It's 120 minutes. Hmm. You want me to think about nothing but your movie? You'd better grab me. And you'd better make sure that every once in a while, you re-grab me.
Yeah.
So the plot needs to move forward a little. Just something new needs to happen. We need to have a reason to go somewhere else. We need to have a new bit of intimidation. We need to have a new bit of love. Mm. Something. But you can be pretty flexible about what.
Mm.
You really can. I've seen movies where almost nothing happens and I'm completely enraptured. And I've seen movies where there's a ton of incidents and I'm bored out of my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is where a lot of the art comes from, is being able to understand how to balance these things.
Mm.
I generally agree. I look at the plot of the new Dune and I get it now, but I care less because all of the weird human stuff that makes the world feel lived in is gone.
Mm.
And all it is plot. And I'm not invested in that because the plot is just the stuff that happens.
They're not even
doing a good job of really getting into the themes of it very well. So that for me was a perfect illustration. I was thinking a lot about that metaphor while I was watching it.
Yeah. But that's something I've been sticking by, and it's a belabored metaphor, but it's one I've been using for a while, so I guess I'll stick with it.
Well, the longer you do a job, the more you come up with, like, your own ideas about it. And I think any critic who does this consistently and not just like once in a while, but as a job for a while, after a while they'll have their own theories.
Yeah,
we should really start a new Cahiers du Cinéma,
but one that's not going to be bought out by Weed Bros or whatever.
Oh, God. you made me weep, dude.
I know the shuttering of Cahiers du Cinéma is like one of the biggest blows.
Kudos to the people at Cahiers du Cinéma, by the way, was the snootiest film magazine in history. They had the absolute most outlandish standards, and bless them for it. And they gave birth to, they helped give birth to the French New Wave. A lot of the filmmakers were initially critics for the Cahiers du Cinéma. And not that long ago, when they were finally purchased by like a corporate entity of some kind, everyone fucking walked.
They just walked right away.
They were just we can't work under this system. We cannot make the compromises you need to compromise because all we care about is our critical integrity. And all the magazine had, what they bought,
was their integrity.
And when you basically make a flat-out statement and say, this magazine has no integrity anymore, this magazine was built on integrity, it's gone, and so are we. And I did a standing ovation, in my apartment when I heard that. It made me so happy.
Yeah,
it's sad the magazine is what it is now, but, it's good for them.
Mm.
All right, that is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, who wrote in. We're sorry if we didn't get to your email. Please, you know, give us some time, or eventually we do move on. We can't, you know, if we did everything in chronological order, we would be so backlogged. But if there's anything important you want us to get to, maybe it's timely for some reason, feel free to nudge us on Twitter. We are at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William DeBiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
Whitney's the person to talk to. He's in charge of the emails. Yeah, we're also, we accept your emails at letters@criticallyacclaimed.com. Wow, it's okay.
www.internet.com.
Yeah. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. That is the email address. No. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
Be sure to listen to our podcast at podcast.com.
You know what?
I'm kidding. Right. I'll stop giving you crap.
Thank you. It's late. I screwed up. Anyway, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box. Good luck getting that one right, Whitney. There's like 9 numbers in there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't remember 9 numbers. Write us in at the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
What? All right, well, Whitney's better than I am. I can accept that.
Just maybe just more caffeinated, I think.
There you go. Anyway, we said the whole Twitter thing. And thank you, everyone. Thank you to all of our patrons, without whom our show would not exist. If you want access to our exclusive shows on the Patreon, it is patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We get a lot of stuff over there. And seriously, the lights would not be on were it not for our patrons. So thank you, everybody, who joins in. That's it. We'll be back next week with more letters and stuff. Have a great week. Stay safe and sane. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Winnie.